So this is Wednesday, October 25th, right, 2013. And this is the third and last of a series of talks that I've been giving related to the general idea of taking in the good and why that's important, what the context of that is, and how we can actually use these methods for our personal practice. And I'm giving this talk in what is for us, of course, a Buddhist setting. And I'm trying to talk about this in a way that would be generally useful because we'll post these talks pretty broadly, as best we can.
It's not October yet, it's September.
Is it September? Yes, see, I'm befuddled. I have a cold. Oh. So thanks. It's September 26, 2013. 25th. But nobody noticed either. That's right. There we are. We're close. It's always, I had a friend who had a watch. It always said now, right? So anyway, that's pretty good. Okay. Anyway, so what in the world am I talking about? Quick recap. Let's see. 2 weeks ago, the first in this series, I talked about how you can use your mind to change your brain. Pretty basic, pretty great. Second talk last week was about the three ways to engage the mind, three ways to practice. We can first be with what's there without trying to influence it. Or second, we can reduce what's negative. Or third, we can increase what's positive. If the mind could be likened to a garden, we can witness the garden, we can pull the weeds, and we can plant flowers. All three are important. My focus in this series of presentations is on the third of these, the planting flowers aspect of practice, and it's important for me to put it in context. Okay. Now, today, I'd really like to talk about the how-to. How do you actually grow good stuff inside yourself? How do you get those flowers to take root in the garden of the mind when, as we've talked about before, the brain has a negativity bias? Using the metaphor of the garden still, that soil is very fertile for weeds because Mother Nature needed our ancestors to learn quickly and well and hold on to the learning from painful, frightening, threatening, frustrating, loneliness-inducing experiences. Because if our ancestors ever survived those experiences, they needed to learn from them deeply so they could avoid them in the future. Because they may not get it. They might not have gotten a second chance to survive. That's the negativity bias of the brain, which on the other hand makes the brain very inefficient at internalizing positive experiences and turning them into happiness inside or feeling loved inside or feeling loving inside or wisdom or mindfulness or virtue inside. The brain is very inefficient at turning positive experiences into these inner resources, inner strengths, even though the basis of the inner strengths like happiness or lovingness or resilience, determination, or virtue, the basis of those inner strengths is primarily positive experiences. In effect, there's a kind of bottleneck in the brain that makes it hard to get those positive experiences to become inner strengths. What are we going to do about this? Well, that's where we have the opportunity to use the power of the mind to change the brain, to pop open that bottleneck, and let positive experiences come into ourselves in such a way that they gradually change brain structure. So I'd like to talk about how to do it, first of all, and then talk about two kinds of applications, both of which are fundamental to life, including to Buddhist practice. So, how do you turn a positive experience into lasting brain structure? Because we have the opportunity to do that in the most important minute of our life, which is the next one, minute after minute after minute after minute, right? We can't do anything about the past. Much more than a minute into the future, our influence starts to fade rapidly. But we have pretty good influence over the next minute in terms of the range of possibility. What will we do with the most important minute of our life? The next one, minute after minute after minute, all the minutes of our lives. As I say in Tibet, if you take care of the minutes, the years will take care of themselves. The way the brain forms structure, as you may have heard me say, is not the way you install songs in an iPod, right? If we want to get songs in an iPod, we just kind of hook it up to our computer or log on our internet, Wi-Fi or whatever, and we just kind of transfer them over. Yep, they're there. The way you get songs into the brain, the way the brain records the good music we all want to get inside ourselves, is you've got to play it. It's like an old school cassette recorder or a modern day DVR. You record it by playing it. We have to have the experience and sustain the experience for it to sink into our brain. So there's three basic steps with an optional bonus step if you want. The first step is to have the positive experience in the first place, either because you notice you're already having it or because you create it. So let's use an example of kindness for others. That's a common example in Buddhist practice as well as other traditions around the world and secular humanism and all the rest, and good old common sense. You know, as the rules in kindergarten, I love those rules that are often posted. Pay attention, be nice, share your toys, right? Like, are those rules to live by or not, or what? So, the experience of kindness, caring for others. So we might notice we're already feeling caring, or kind, or supportive, or friendly, or affectionate, or even loving, or let's say appreciating towards somebody. Or we might deliberately not just notice it, we might deliberately create that positive experience to have it in the first place. We might call to mind someone and think to ourselves, may you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you live with ease. We might deliberately create a positive experience. Okay? So now we've activated it. Okay? It's a little bit like a fire. The first step of taking in the good is to light the fire. We have to have the positive experience in the first place. In the second step, we begin to install this activated experience into brain structure. We add fuel to the fire by helping the experience last, and as well, if it's appropriate, one or more of four additional ways to turn experiences into brain structure. Intensity, that's the second way besides duration. Intensity, we help it become intense. We grow the feeling of being loving. We give ourselves over to it. We let it pervade the mind. Third, multimodality. We try to feel it as an emotion in our body. We might even enact it by reaching out our hand as if we were reaching out our hand in a loving way, or letting a facial expression of kindness, caring, come in to our face, right? Multimodality. The fourth way to enrich an experience, enrich being the second step of taking the good, is to see the novelty in things, to see what's fresh about these positive experiences instead of being jaded about them. What's sometimes called beginner's mind, Zen mind, don't know mind, right? Where we can look at the world through the eyes of a child and take a familiar experience of gratitude or determination or lovingness and see what's fresh about it. And then last, the fifth factor, well established in oodles of studies in psychology that increases learning, including emotional learning that we're talking about here, is personal relevance. Seeing for ourselves why it would be relevant to me to cultivate, let's say, loving kindness for others, in my example here. Okay? So far I'm in the second step of taking in the good. The first step, have the positive experience, activate it, and then in the second step, begin to install it through enriching it. Third step, which overlaps the second, and you can use this yourself every day, a few times a day, to help the good stuff sink into you. The third step, A for absorb. We prime memory systems by intending and sensing that the experience is going into us. All right, so for example, we might imagine or sense that the feeling of lovingness or kindness or compassion is sinking into us like water into a sponge. With children, I'll talk about putting a jewel in the treasure chest of the heart. You might have a sense of warmth going into you, like the warmth of a cup of hot cocoa into your hands on a cold winter's day. Or maybe there's just a knowing that somehow this experience is sinking in. There's an intending to give oneself over to it, to let oneself be changed just a little bit by this experience. There's a traditional saying, the mind takes its shape from what it rests upon. Resting our mind upon a positive experience, such as feeling loving or kind, we're allowing our mind's shape to shift just a little bit, to be willing to budge, to become a little different, to have the courage, in some sense, to die a little bit to the old self, to grow a little bit into a new one. Right? That's essentially the third step of taking the good. That process, which I've kind of unpacked, you know, can sound complicated. In ordinary life, it usually takes 10 or 20 seconds. You know, if you were to summarize the whole practice in four words, it would be have it, enjoy it. That's it. Enjoy it. We're very good at having positive experiences, both informally in our hedonistic culture and more formally through practices in human resource trainings in corporations, in psychotherapy, in character education for children, or in just everyday efforts to try to enjoy life. We're pretty good at having positive experiences, but I think we're really lousy at installing them. We're really lousy at helping them sink into us. Consequently, most positive experiences are wasted on the brain. Even though they're the primary source of positive mood, resilience, and other inner strengths that we all want. All right. So those are the three basic steps, H-E-A, and have, enrich, absorb. The fourth step, a bonus one, is LINK, L for LINK. So it gives you an acronym that's easy to remember, HEAL, H-E-A-L, have, enrich, absorb, LINK. LINK simply means that while experiencing a positive experience in the foreground of awareness, also being aware of something negative. So that, because neurons that fire together wire together, the positive material starts going into, weaving its way into the negative material, gradually soothing it and eventually potentially replacing it. In effect, flowers start crowding out weeds, and actually eventually flowers can replace weeds in the garden of the mind. That's the essence of taking in the good. I did not invent this practice. What I've tried to do, though, is really understand its steps and help people become very, very skillful at it. Okay. Any quick questions so far on the actual practice itself? Because Coach Rick here wants you to get very good at this.
Yeah. You said five things. Duration of the good feeling, intensity of the good feeling, multimodality, which I think you gave me a little of touch.
Yeah, helping the idea become an experience. It's okay to help wise views sink in. You know, you may have heard me use the example. In my 20s, I realized that growing up, I'd been a nerd but not a wimp. That's a very good idea for me to have. It was very useful, right? Other times you realize you have other different kinds of ideas. Like you realize, I need to put my keys in one place every time. Otherwise, I'm going to lose them, let alone my glasses, my smartphone, my mind, etc. So, you know, whatever. We let it sink in. Or we realize, it works better when I'm talking with my partner if I start by joining, rather than start by analytically solving problems. Oh, that's a useful idea, right? Trust me, I've benefited from that idea in my marriage. All right. Anyway, so my point is, yes, you're exactly right. It's okay in the third to have the idea, but mostly where we get the value, it's through sensations in the body and emotion and also desire, helping wholesome desires sink in, as well as wholesome emotions or body sensations. You're exactly right. That's the third step, multimodality.
And then the last two?
The fourth is novelty. The brain is a novelty detector. the newer it is, the fresher it is, you know, the more it's as if we let each breath be a fresh breath, each moment of loving kindness be a fresh moment of loving kindness, and so forth. That sinks in. And then last, personal relevance. Why should I care? Why should I allocate processing power to this? You know, the brain basically registers what's personally meaningful while it filters out everything else. Okay?
Okay, awesome.
Yeah, and there's tons and tons and tons of research literature on these five factors. There are probably other factors, but these are the ones that have really popped out for me as hugely influential. They make sense if you think about it, and they're very effective. Minimally duration. There's kind of a critical period. If you're not aware of information, including experiences, long enough for it to transfer out of short-term memory buffers down into long-term storage, it just washes through short-term memory buffers without transferring, like water sheeting over a driveway. But if you stay with it long enough, which depends on the person, the situation, the experience, and so forth, but if you stay with it long enough, it can then start encoding a neural structure so it has lasting value. And you're taking it with you, not wasting it. Long enough, you know, could be 5, 10, or 20 seconds in a row. If you really want to boil everything tonight down into two words, not even four, mo beta. Walk out of here, there's a little mantra, mo beta. You know, more episodes per day of taking in the good, and in each episode, mo beta. You know, letting it sink in, staying in with it longer, letting it be a kind of concentration or absorption practice in contemplative terms. Actually, if I could, I want to talk now about two different kinds of applications, and then we can have even more discussion about this, okay? So, one way to use taking in the good is for general purposes. Why not? Why not take in good experiences instead of wasting them? It's like we walk in life down the path, and we're continually stepping over the jewels, right? We don't notice the good facts to begin with. Why not notice them? Second, if we notice them, why not have an experience of them, not just the empty idea? Someone gives us a compliment, right? We accomplish something, we finish something. A bad thing that could have happened doesn't, whatever. Do we actually let the idea of this become a felt sense in the body? No, usually we don't notice the good facts, and if we do, we waste them by not letting them become good experiences. Or even if we notice a good fact, we let it become a good experience, do we take the 10 seconds to install it in the brain? Or do we let it just wash through our brain like water through a sieve yet again? So we can be on our own side, we can use everyday life as opportunities half a dozen times a day or more, to let the good stuff actually land so it has some kind of lasting value. That, yeah.
How do you walk me through a habit? Say you're, you know, I'll just randomly pick anything. You're in the supermarket and you decide to let somebody go and ahead of you, right?
Okay.
You know, how do you let this go onto your hard drive? Just walk me through this, what you would say.
Great, I love it. I'm glad you did that. Thank you. So, you're in the supermarket, and first of all, life is full of good facts that we hardly notice, like the fact that we're in a supermarket stuffed with food. You know what I mean? Like, whoa, you know? Or that's pretty cool, or even visually, aesthetically, like supermarkets are just color and bright and wow, you know? Okay, but that said, let's suppose you let someone else go in front of you in line. Good fact, opportunity for a good experience. Oh, without getting grandiose or arrogant about it, oh yeah, there's a kindness in my heart. My intentions were good, right? And I might even have had not so good intentions alongside the good intentions. Maybe I, speaking of myself here, thought, boy, I'm gonna look so good, you know? Let the old lady in front of me, everybody's gonna think, what a nice man he is. So often that happens, but we fear that our good intentions our bad intentions, if you will, or our less than noble intentions, contaminate our noble ones. They don't, actually. They really don't, you know, just part right there. Okay, so now we let the person go ahead, good fact, And let's suppose that we're just feeling kind of warm. On the 0 to 10 intensity scale, it's a 1. It still counts. So we notice it. Okay, so now we begin. I'm having a positive experience. There's a warmth in me. Oh. Then what I do, hypothetically, is a little voice inside, could be my voice in the beginning, before it becomes yours, says, have it, enjoy it, you know, stay with it. Why not? You've earned it. It's wholesome. It's actually good for others, for you to let your own warm-heartedness sink into you. As we register increasingly, you know, and the Buddha said, find gladness in your goodness. As we increasingly take gladness in our goodness, we actually become nicer, and we become more inclined to be nicer to others in the future. So from the standpoint of benevolence, being pro-social, it's actually beneficial for them, for oneself, to register warm-heartedness, let's say. Okay? So I'm knowing why I'm doing it. This is very important. Why am I doing this thing? Right? For 10 seconds straight. So then you just kind of hang out with it. You might feel it in your heart. You might watch your mind starting to get distracted, as it often does, or go negative. Yeah, but you weren't so nice yesterday. Yeah, you yelled at the kids. Duh. You know, later, Gator. I'm zeroed in on taking in the good for 20 flipping seconds. Can you give me 20 seconds? All right? You know, a little bit of that. You protect. You're on your side. You create sanctuary for it. You want to protect your little garden, poor little garden. You want to help it sink in. So you stay with it, warms, enjoying it, exploring it. What's it like to feel warm? Wow. And then kind of like a sense of it sinking in, receiving it, a little bit of yielding to it. It's kind of intimate with yourself, letting it come in and even sensing in some subtle way that I'm becoming just a little warmer as a result of actually internalizing this positive experience. And then, kawoosh, now it's my turn to make Safeway richer, right? See, right? That's great. And there are many opportunities like that in everyday life. Like for me, it was plucky that you prodded me to slow it down and let it in, you know, and talk about that. That's an opportunity to go, whoa, plucky, a little appropriately assertive. Good. Let it sink in, you know? Okay, great. So you got the basic idea. We all know how to take in the good. We've all had experiences of letting a nice moment land. And I'm really talking about using this practice from the standpoint of a very clear-eyed understanding about the negativity bias of the brain, and also a recognition that to deal with life, let alone to do spiritual practice, we need to build up good stuff inside ourselves. For me, taking the good is not about positive thinking, which is usually wasted on the brain, because those thoughts don't become experiences that sink into neural structure. Nor is it about looking on the bright side. Actually, paradoxically, the more that we see the good facts, and we allow ourselves to have legitimate, typically earned good experiences, the more that we do that and build up resources inside, the more capable we become of seeing and dealing with the hard things in life. It's a very important frame here for me. So we can use these methods in two kinds of ways. The first way I'll call sort of the ordinary way. The ordinary way includes developing a greater sense of gratitude and well-being and optimism and everyday effectiveness. And also, we can use the ordinary way to take in the good to heal old pain. We can deliberately look for those key experiences that are the antidotes to what ails us. They're the medicine for what ails us. And to use a framework that I have found very helpful, grounded in the evolution of the brain, we basically have three kinds of needs: safety, satisfaction, and connection. In effect, the brain uses three overarching systems to meet these needs. We avoid harms, we approach rewards, and we attach to others. And to use a metaphor that's an easy way to remember this, these needs are loosely related to the three stages of brain evolution. We need to help the little inner lizard feel safe. We need to help the little inner mouse feel satisfied and fed. And we need to help the little inner monkey feel loved. All right? So if you've heard me say this probably, in a way, we need to pet the lizard, you know, feed the mouse, and hug the monkey. Okay. And so here's the deal. If we have issues with safety, positive experiences in the approaching reward system are not going to be very helpful. For example, if you're feeling threatened, gratitude is nice, but it's not going to solve your anxiety. If you're feeling threatened, your boss praising you is nice, but it's not going to make you feel less anxious. Flip the other way. Let's suppose you've recently been hurt in a relationship. Someone's mistreated you or been kind of cold or even, you know, dumped you in some way. So then if you're feeling like you have an issue in terms of your social needs with the attaching to others system, if you feel rewarded, like you get a promotion, that's nice, but I still feel lonely. I still feel abandoned. Or if you buy a lock for your front door, great, now I'm more protected, but I still feel inadequate and unloved and mistreated. We need resource experiences that are targeted to our issues. So I think there are four really powerful questions in a row. One, what's the issue? What's the problem that we're grappling with? Either a difficult situation, or maybe a long-standing issue in our own psychology, or maybe an issue in our personal practice, spiritual practice of some kind. Second question, what if it were more present inside my mind would really help? That's an incredibly useful question. Third, now that I know what that inner resource would be, right? In other words, if I'm feeling anxious, it would help to have more sense inside my mind of being protected or relaxation or inner strength. Or if I'm feeling frustrated or disappointed or like there's a loss, well, it would help me to feel more grateful or glad or pleasured or accomplished. Or if I'm feeling, in terms of the attaching system, if I'm feeling mistreated or inadequate or lonely or unwanted or devalued, left out, voted off the island, as it were, well, then it would serve me to have more experiences of being seen, wanted, included, prized, sought, befriended, liked, appreciated, even loved. See? So then, so you see the examples of answers to the second question? Then once we know what we're looking for, we get the good stuff inside ourselves by having experiences of it. One, now that I know, and my answer to the second question, what it is I'm trying to grow inside myself. Third question, how can I have experiences of this? How can I be a friend to myself and help myself have experiences of this? Either by highlighting experiences of this strength that I'm already having, and instead of wasting them, take the extra 10, 20 seconds to help them sink in, right? Or how can I look for opportunities to have this particular experience that would serve me? When I realized in my late teens and early 20s that I really needed to have experiences of being included and liked, because that's where my personal wounding was, I really looked for opportunities to have those experiences. I looked for evidence that people, they weren't, you know, million-dollar moments. These were not my best friends, but they were moments where people were friendly or appreciative or including or warm or even liking. Gosh, you know? And when I saw them, I knew they were high-value experiences for me. Okay, that's the third question. How could I have more experiences of this inner resource that I need more of inside me? And fourth, once I'm having this experience, once it's activated, fourth, how could I install it in my brain? How can I help it sink in 10 or 20 seconds at a time in the most important minute of my life, the next one? So that's the ordinary use. We can use taking in the good for everyday well-being and effectiveness, and in targeted ways to bring in the key resources, the antidote experiences, the soul food that we really, really need. Okay. Then there's the, I don't know what to call it. I'll call it the extraordinary use of taking in the good. In the Buddhist model of our suffering, which is utterly psychological, you know, the Four Noble Truths, as you may know, there is a truth of suffering, which is an experience. Suffering is an experience ranging from subtle stress or discontent or unease or unsatisfactoriness of things, all the way out to excruciating mental or physical anguish. Second, in the Buddha's model, a primary, if not the primary source of our suffering is, in a single broad umbrella term, craving. Or in more conventional language, drivenness, pressure, resisting in terms of the avoiding system of the brain, grasping, chasing in terms of the approaching rewards system of the brain, or clinging, clutching in terms of the attaching to others system of the brain. That kind of drivenness leads to unease and disturbance, contraction, creates vicious negative cycles with other people. That's the Buddha's model. See for ourselves, right? Then in the Third Noble Truth, there's the truth of the end of the cause of suffering, which is to say, the end of the craving that leads to suffering and harm. And then in the Fourth Noble Truth, we have the path, the Eightfold Path, that both embodies less suffering and greater happiness and is also a path to it. Okay. So here's the question. If in the Buddhist model, the cause of suffering is craving, what's the cause of craving? Why do we crave? From a psychological, biological perspective, grounded in evolution, we crave because of an underlying sense of deficit or disturbance. That's the source of craving. So the Third Noble Truth is the truth of reducing craving, ending eventually craving. How do you actually do that with a biology that has evolved over, you know, 600 million years in terms of the nervous system, grounded on nearly 3 billion years before that of life altogether? How do we help ourselves come to the end of craving when we have an organism that survives through craving and suffering and craving? You know, survives through the, you know, being able to suffer, which generates craving, and then survives through craving that leads to more suffering while also passing on genes. This is where the extraordinary usage of taking in the good comes in. Because when we take in the good, in the moment of taking it in terms of our core needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection, in that moment we have an opportunity to experience that our core needs have been met. In this moment, we are truly safe. Or we can experience in this moment, we are truly full. There is everything that we need here. Or in the moment, we can experience we are truly connected, included, liked enough, loved enough, popular enough, valued enough. And in this moment, it's possible through registering good experiences that in that moment at least, there's no true basis for craving. There's no deficit. Nothing is missing. There's no disturbance. And through repeatedly internalizing wholesome positive experiences, repeatedly registering the sense of no deficit and no disturbance, gradually we can weave into the fabric of our being an unconditional sense of needs met, of safety, of satisfaction and connection, so there's no actual basis for the craving that leads to suffering and harm. That's the extraordinary usage of taking the good, to gradually cultivate such a profound sense of all rightness and fullness and loved and lovingness that there's no natural basis for any craving or harm. Okay. What do you think about that? Yeah.
I've just got to mention this. I had a little was so much grief that I said, no more. I just can't have any more. I can't go through this. And then one night I said, well, I wonder what the Marin Humane Society has. They never have anything I like anyway. And there he was. I just fell in love. And I got to tell you, the difference, this is so exactly what you're talking about. The difference in me, after he came, this lovely, darling, two-year-old, totally undisciplined, totally loving, changed me. I mean, I was just, and it's continual.
Yeah, that's
you
great.
Know, I could even cry because
yeah.
He has made my life so bright. And it's constant.
Yeah.
It's constant. I almost don't want to train him. He's so bad. He's so loving. You know? If I train him, you know, to walk right, do this right, that right.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I would lose this wonderful. It's just exactly what you're talking about. I had to mention this.
Oh, thank you.
You know,
and
because it's constant with me, and it is changing.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
changing everything.
That's great.
Yeah. My other dog, well, he was 10, he didn't like to hang with dogs. But this one, in the park, I just let him off the leash and he tears over there to the other dogs and plays with them. And so that there's a period
yeah.
in my life that, you know, I'm watching him play and roughhouse with the dog, with other dogs.
That's great.
It's just...
So if I could build on what you're saying, you know, and then I'll have to wrap it up pretty quickly, just for the sake of everybody as well as for my own voice. You're right. You're in your point that when we experience needs met, like a loving dog and also delight and pleasure and all the rest of that, something in us changes. We come to a kind of peace. You know, where I started tonight in the practice was around picking up the idea of refuge, right? You know, we feel, at ease, right? And to build on what you're saying, it's of course really important to register these experiences, including wonderful experiences with a dog or with friends, so that we become increasingly independent of whether the condition is present outside us in our life. So that even when or if we're separated eventually from all that we love one day, one way or another, right? Which faces all of us, that through repeatedly internalizing 10,000 times, I think, 10 seconds at a time, through repeatedly internalizing the felt sense of, safety, satisfaction, and connection, so we can go green, as it were, in terms of how we feel inside, then increasingly we carry that with us wherever we go. And that then becomes a beautiful path of practice. Actually, if you think about it, you know, the experience of peace or contentment or love is the aim of a good life in terms of the avoiding, approaching, and attaching systems of the brain. Peace, contentment, and love. But also, because you can use your mind to change your brain to change your mind, if you register again and again and again, if we register again and again and again, experiences in a deep level of peace, contentment, and love, we take them in over time, and peace, contentment, and love increasingly becomes how we approach life. It becomes where we come from, not so much what we're going to. In effect, as they say in Tibet, we take the fruit, the aims of a good life, peace, contentment, and love, as the path. We take the fruit as the path. Finishing with a quote from the Buddha, if I could. And this is a lot of material and a big chunk. I really invite you to explore this for yourself. You know, as the Buddha says here, and I'll quote him to begin with, he says, think not lightly of good, saying it will not come to me. Drop by drop is the water pot filled. Likewise, the wise one fills oneself with good. So on that note, how about we sit for a quiet, good minute and wrap it up. And to be clear, we're not clinging to positive experiences, nor are we trying to turn them into things. Paradoxically, we are opening to positive experiences in a very intimate way, out of kindness and wisdom, kindness to ourselves and wisdom altogether. We're opening to them to help them sink in. So gradually over time, there's less and less need for them to be provided from the outside in, because we've grown them inside ourselves, inside out. The gradual cultivation of an internal sense of peace, contentment, and love undoes craving. May all beings take in the good. Thank you. Take care.